The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering troubleshooting and repair services for broken or problematic Macs, iPads, and iPhones, both in warranty and out. More information at TechServe.com.
This is The Takeaway. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm John Hockenberry, and we are coming to you from the studios of St. Louis Public Radio. Today and tomorrow, we will be introducing you to folks from this important city at the crossroads of the Midwest, the South, and the West, with a little East Coast, West Coast spirit of entrepreneurism thrown in for good measure. This is a city in the grip of very familiar baseball fever. The Cardinals are on the roll. Are they the Yankees of the National League, or is it the Yankees who are the Cardinals of the American League? Well, the Yankees are out, folks, and the people here know the answer to that question. It's definitely the St. Louis Cardinals. And in the shadow of the world-famous Gateway Arch, this is a city also shadowed by the racial tensions of nearby Ferguson. We will speak of both later this hour, but a 20-year-old computer science student we met named Kia, who worked this year at St. Louis's biggest tourist attraction, told us that the Silver Arch, which was built to signify a city's rebirth and revitalization 50 years ago this month, still has a ways to go to bring this community together.
A lot of stuff has to stop happening in the city with black-on-black crime and racism and also police brutality. So it's not just going to be just the arch making a difference. A lot of things within the city itself has to change first, I feel like, in order for the arch to really represent St. Louis.
We'll hear more from Kia and the fans of the 50-year-old Gateway Arch we met last night on a beautiful early fall evening down by the Mississippi River in St. Louis later this hour. But first, we want to continue our mission this week to try and puncture the rhetorical stalemate over gun control, gun ownership, and mass shootings in America. Yesterday, we had an ornery conversation with gun control advocate and British Observer of America, Piers Morgan, former TV host and now an editor-at-large for the London Daily Mail.
I do think that if Americans had to be confronted with the reality of gun violence in terms of imagery, it would make a massive difference. A picture does tell a thousand words.
We follow that up today with a conversation with the very ornery and popular radio host, Tom Gresham, whose Gun Talk Radio is just that, the only nationally syndicated radio talk show about firearms, shooting, and gun rights. He can talk forever, and while he believes mass shootings like the one last week in Oregon are bad, are they an argument for making it harder for anyone to purchase a gun in the United States? Nope, not even close.
I guess the question is, when is the time to talk about gun control, and what gun control are they talking about? You know, it's very interesting, John, that we have, in the last 20 years, gun crime has gone down almost 50%. We have more guns, millions more guns, millions more gun users, and yet crime with guns has gone down by almost 50% with no new gun laws. So one wonders, why are we talking about having more gun laws?
Right. Of course, that didn't answer the question. The question was, why should we not talk about them after there's been a mass shooting?
Well, I just flipped that on its head and said, why should we talk about them at all? Well, you know, timing has nothing to do with it. The Centers for Disease Control 2 years ago came out with a study that said they could find no evidence that any gun control law had ever reduced crime. So the question, I flip it around and say, why talk about it at all if we can't find any evidence that it works and crime is going down, gun crime is going down? Why would anybody want to be talking about gun control?
All right. So then let's focus on this question of a mass school shooting. You think it's just another crime story? It's not something that we need to focus on differently? I mean, in Scandinavia, they certainly took a look at that mass shooting as a very different national tragedy than other crimes that took place in Scandinavia. You don't think we should do the same thing?
Well, sure. We should absolutely address any type of crime and to say, okay, let's talk about school shootings. First of all, we have to identify, because, I mean, look, any is wrong, any is too many, but it's not the number that you've been told, and it's not the number that you're repeating. So let's address the real thing. We've got to talk about people who go into a school to kill school children or the people who are there. All right, we can work on that one. So if we start from that, what can we do about that?
All right? That's what I asked you.
All right, fair enough. What can we do about that? We kill the SOBs as soon as they walk in the door. We have armed guards at banks, and we don't have armed guards at schools. Do we love our money more than we do our children?
I think yes, that's the case. We love our guns more than we do our children. We love our guns more than we do having safe schools. We love our guns more than racial harmony in America. I mean, I think we love our guns more than a lot of things in the United States. That seems to be where we are right now.
I guess what I would say is that Americans look at the news, they analyze the real stats on this, and they say, okay, I understand where you're wanting to go with this, but we've looked at it and said, but a reduction in guns does not equate to a reduction in crime. And that's inherent in what your position is here, John, what you're saying, we should do something about guns, i.e.
I didn't say we should do anything. I'm just saying, where do Americans stand?
But we're inherent in what you're asking me is Americans seem unwilling to do something about this. It's what you're saying. And you know, there's no point playing games with it. That's what you're saying.
It's the public record.
What I'm saying is that Americans have looked at this and said gun control laws don't work, that gun control laws do not reduce crime. It's not that they're unwilling to go there. It's that they have looked at it, analyzed it, and chosen and said, no, that's a failed policy. There's no point in continuing with a policy that doesn't work. You almost make it sound like, gee, they're not aware. If we only made them more aware, they would support more gun control.
Putting words in my mouth.
That's not what it is. They looked at it and said, no, this doesn't work.
For whatever reason. I mean, I'm not going to psychoanalyze them like you are, but for whatever reason, they're not going to go there. Do you think the CDC should study gun violence as a public health matter?
If they would do it in a way that does not have the stated end goal of ending gun ownership, which is why their funding got removed in the first place, the head of the CDC said 20 years ago, our goal is to make guns like cigarettes, dirty, filthy, and banned. If they wanted to study firearm accidents or deaths or whatever without a goal of saying we want to ban guns, because I think that's
so. So you would study Ebola without a intent of getting rid of Ebola. You would just study Ebola without actually wanting to eradicate what's causing the deaths. That's what the CDC would do? I mean, are you serious?
You're equating gun ownership with Ebola?
Guns kill. Diseases kill. It's a public health issue.
Guns save.
Cars kill.
How many people are saved with guns? You have no idea. Guns do not equal crime, and guns do not equal killing.
So guns are these very interesting objects that happen to occasionally kill people, and to think of them as any sort of public health matter is a bizarre distortion of what guns are all about.
Look, I know where you're coming from. I get it. Understand it. You think that guns are primarily used for crime.
No, you don't know what I think, Tom.
I'm equating it from your questions carry so much subtext that it's all right there, John.
Tom, you're saying that guns are these interesting, historically significant, lovable objects that Americans love to own, and their association with death is a side issue, and we really shouldn't be focusing at all on guns and their ability to kill people.
Does it make sense to say that if fewer than 1% is used in killing, that we should be addressing all guns? Should we not then maybe address the people who are doing the killing and not the instrumentality? Are you aware that more people are killed with fists and feet than they are with semi-automatic rifles, the so-called assault weapons? That's according to the FBI. That's not my number.
Tom, just understand that
your concern is misplaced.
Thank you. And it's not a concern. I'm just asking what we should be talking about when we talk about guns. And you've answered it very well, in fact. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Tom Gresham is the host of Gun Talk Radio, the only nationally syndicated radio talk show about firearms, shooting, and gun rights. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, broadcasting from St. Louis, home of the 50-year-old Gateway Arch, where they come from far.
Vancouver, Canada.
And they come from wide.
Oklahoma.
We're from Bowling Green, Kentucky.
At just before 6 p.m. at the National Gateway Arch, the golden sunset casts a parade of long fall shadows from the steady stream of tourists still visiting just before closing time. This shimmering, metal-perfect parabolic arch rises from the ancient banks of the Mississippi River like some calling card left by intergalactic aliens.
Go touch the arch. Go touch the arch.
It does look like the remains of an alien civilization, though, doesn't it?
Yeah. What planet do you think they came from?
Oh, I don't know that.
Pluto.
The National Park Rangers run the place, but seemed wary of the media around closing time. This ranger talked like we had stumbled into Area 51 in Roswell. She had no clearance to talk to us.
Anything that you want from an employee needs to go through the superintendent's office.
But of course, anyone can go up in the arch, riding in little pods that take you up 630 feet. Now that's...
It's good.
Good?
Yeah.
It was different. It kind of a clanking, a rotating. Yeah. It was started state of the art back in the 60s, but now it seems like ancient.
Making you a little nervous?
Yeah. No, it wasn't. It was just pretty cool what it was doing and how they actually got you up to the top. It was pretty neat.
I remember it like it was just yesterday, almost 50 years ago, going up in the arch as a little kid. We rode in tiny little pods that looked like Alka-Seltzer pills or poker chips with just four seats each. It's still the weirdest, noisiest elevator ride, as you can hear from this YouTube video. Moving up and sideways at the same time, out of the little windows at the top, you could see the same horizon explorers Lewis and Clark saw more than 200 years ago, and the millions of settlers who followed them west, giving St. Louis the gateway name. My parents took us to every USA historical tourist attraction, from Paul Revere's ride to the Cowboy Hall of Fame to the Hearst Castle and everything in between. The Gateway Arch, though, was the strangest and the coolest. Cool because it was so visually magical, like a chain loop for giants to attach a winch and just pick up the state of Missouri and haul it away. Strange because it seemed so unconnected with the rest of the city. I remember the smell of Switzer's candy ropes being made back in the 60s, one of the few things operating on the riverfront then. All gone and totally changed today. Cornell Harvey was a Boy Scout back in 1965 who was there on a hot October day at the dedication of the last segment of the arch. A 14-year-old then, he is retired, living in the suburbs today.
Well, back then it was like the gateway to the West. It was like a key figure for anybody that was visiting to have like something they could pinpoint on St. Louis that this was the gateway to the West, which it was. I have traveled all over the world, and any place that you go to, if you tell them that you're from St. Louis, the first thing they say is, you've got the arch. You're from St. Louis, you've got the arch. So it's monumental.
20-year-old college student Kia, who's lived all her life in St. Louis and works at the arch today, says that it is still remote from the city. As much as she loves the arch, she says it still has some work to do to live up to its promise to the people of St. Louis.
Definitely has a lot of work to do. I feel like the arch could symbolize it to make it, you know, move forward. But a lot of times things just happen. It's never going to change to me personally. But it's good to have something in the city to represent. This is what we stand for, the Westford expansion. Actually seeing growth, that's what it all was about, to expand the United States. So a lot of stuff has to stop happening in the city with black-on-black crime and racism and also police brutality. So it's not just going to be just the arch making a difference. A lot of things within the city itself has to change first, I feel like, in order for the arch to really represent St. Louis.
As we left the arch, as the sun was setting, a little girl was looking up at the top, which seems to stretch forever. She kept touching the metal. Her parents kept trying to get her to go, but she kept saying, I'm touching the arch. I'm touching the arch. Maybe she was getting a message from the aliens. We are here today and tomorrow at St. Louis Public Radio. Stay with us. A lot of local folks we spoke with in St. Louis were very excited about the first night of the baseball divisional playoffs. The powerhouse Cardinals will be facing their northern rivals up Interstate 55, the Chicago Cubs, tomorrow night. Don't make plans here in the city except to watch the game or maybe to order pizza. This place shuts down for the playoffs and the Cardinals. Joining me here in the St. Louis Public Radio studio is Joe Holloman, the completely objective columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Joe, welcome, welcome.
Thank you. Well, appreciate it.
First, the state of the Cards. How are they fixed for a long, long haul in this playoff series?
As always, as a St. Louis, we're worried, John. We're desperately worried. We're nervous. We always see the sky falling, even when we win the World Series.
So that would make the Cubs fans delusional.
Oh, absolutely. Well, that almost went without saying, but no, the Cardinals fret. St. Louis fans fret over the Cardinals. It doesn't matter how many successes we have. We wait for that other shoe to drop. It's just what we do.
Why is this city such a baseball town? And as I roam around the city, how do I feel it in the fabric of this this place on all sides, black, white, everybody?
The reasons, I think there are several. One is almost just the fact that we had no other professional sport in St. Louis until major sport, football, till 1960, when the Chicago Cardinals moved to St. Louis and immediately gave us a dozen years of mediocrity, and they were Chicago's rejects. My father never rooted for the football Cardinals because they were Chicago's rejects. So we had a 60, 70-year head start where baseball was the only sport in town. So I think that's one thing that, let's say, at Pittsburgh that had the Steelers or the Bears in Chicago, we had nothing to split our allegiance. It was baseball. A second thing is I think that in the early 50s, Anheuser-Busch bought the Cardinals.
Right.
And Anheuser-Busch was a company, one of the largest in St. Louis, still is, that employed a lot of blue-collar working-class folks who followed team sports. So I think it was a combination of a team we were proud of, with a business that we were proud of. So there was this kind of symbiosis that was created there, two things to be proud of. And the third, we've been really good over 80 years. So I think those three things are the reasons.
You know, it's kind of a interesting sponsorship model, the Anheuser-Busch company buying the Cardinals. It's a sort of it was an innovative move for a corporate sponsor for a sports team that really we see replicated in the NFL today, but it's also a little bit like the Green Bay Packers because there's this working class element. Everybody feels like they have a stake in the Cards.
I think that is, and a lot of that had to do with the no other team, like with Green Bay. I mean, there were the Milwaukee baseball teams, but our own city just had the Packers in Green Bay, and we have the Cardinals. And I think St. Louis has been innovative in baseball. I think two of the greatest innovations in the sport came out of St. Louis, Branch Rickey and the creation of a farm system of teams. That also helped spread the Cardinal magic, if you will, or make Cardinal Nation extend into Oklahoma and Texas and Colorado. And then you have the corporate buying of a team where it wasn't just some rich individual, it was now a corporate entity. So I think St. Louis has been revolutionary, not only on the field in baseball, but certainly off the field as well.
What's the chance that the Cardinals going to the series will muss up Bob Costas's hair? He's a big fan. And speak to the Mets fans out there, speak to the other fans out there, the Dodgers fans in the National League who are really hoping to bring the Cardinals down, and of course the Cubs fans.
Little or no chance that Bob Costas' hair gets messed up.
Yeah.
I'd say that's a 10-1 against.
Okay.
The Mets, we have a bad history with the Mets from the 1980s. They are affectionately referred to in St. Louis as pond scum.
Ooh.
Yes.
So affectionately.
They will always be pond scum. The Dodgers, we kind of like playing the Dodgers. We beat them a lot, and B, I think it's the only team in the National League that can rival us if you say, what's the greatest National League franchise? The Yankees in the American League, clearly. In the National League over the years, it's the Dodgers and the Cardinals. So I think, and that's what I think it's going to be. I think it'll be the Dodgers and the Cardinals in the NLCS.
All right. Worried about the injuries that the Cardinals have, but happy about the playoffs. Joe Holloman, the completely objective, as I said, columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Joe, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Danger for reporters in the current conflict in Syria and the war in Afghanistan makes the latest novel from NBC's longtime foreign correspondent Martin Fletcher, both a story about current trials in the deadly game of telling the story from conflict zones and a throwback story to the days when television network news dominated global reporting of wars and disasters. Fletcher's The War Reporter tells the story of Tom Lane, a television correspondent whose life, as is often the case for fearless journalists, is falling apart while reporting from Sarajevo in the 1990s. Tom Lane tries to put his life back together in a partially true, partially fictional yarn about the search for Ratko Mladic, the Serbian butcher and the patriot accused of directing war crimes carried out by the Bosnian Serbs. Martin Fletcher says his need to tell this story is partly because the opportunities for old-style reporting have diminished these days, and novel writing fills the gap, but more because the story was deeply personal.
First of all, Tom Lane, as a television correspondent, being obsessed with being at the center of things, so am I. Mm-hmm. I think all journalists are, because that's where the heart of the story is, at the center of things. So I think that's very common. But in the book, you know, he experiences a terrible tragedy, and his obsession then becomes living with that tragedy, how to overcome it, how to beat post-traumatic stress, which is actually pretty common among people who cover wars. So that will be his challenge to overcome.
And to do it, he thinks he's going to write a documentary or shoot a documentary about Vlatko Mladic in Bosnia that's going to find him, in a sense, bring him to justice on some level and possibly make up for the loss of his friend Nick and the rape of the woman he loves at the hands of Serbian thugs, basically. It's a failed attempt to redeem himself, but it's a common thing that journalists have with them, this documentary that they're going to make that's going to save the world.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, we all want to write the book, make the documentary, make a difference. But actually, I saw him as a metaphor, him and Nina as a metaphor for the bigger picture, which was that the Bosnian wars, after the breakup of Yugoslavia, Bosnia, Croatia, Serbia, Kosovo, these wars had a terrific impact on Europe. So many lives were lost and ruined and refugees created. I felt that, okay, so I'm telling the story about the journalists, but they're telling their story is also the wider story of how do you make up for the death of your friend, for the destruction of your family and of your love. He wanted to make a documentary about Ratko Mladic, who actually was the biggest killer in Europe since Hitler. You know, the Srebrenica massacre, 8,000-9,000 men and boys were massacred by his people.
Do you think a deal was made between the Croats and the Serbs to clear out the area that Srebrenica found itself in, to kind of ethnically cleanse in their own way those territories?
Well, you know, that's the interesting thing, because when I did the research for the book, I went to Belgrade and I spent a few weeks there and I went back and forwards. And I was doing the research as a journalist for my fictional character, Tom Lane. And what I came up with, and this was presented to me by several people, including a colonel in a private military research institute in Belgrade, who said there had to have been a deal, because in Srebrenica, when the United Nations troops failed to protect the Bosnian Muslims under their control, that was only part of the story. Right before that happened, right before the Serbs went in and massacred them, the Muslim army withdrew from Srebrenica. And the question was why? Hmm. Why did they do that? And so there must have been a deal. And in my book, I enumerate what that deal was. Now, did they expect a massacre? They say they didn't. You must have been a real idiot not to think that there wouldn't be a massacre. The Serbs were saying for weeks and months beforehand, the quote from Mladic was, "We'll be up to our knees in blood." And so the idea that the Americans missed that, that's just not possible.
In many ways, the most powerful and current image from your book comes from that astounding opening scene of the little kid with the hare lip who can't afford to get the operation, alone in a room and no one knows what to do with him because his parents are gone. And it's an image you return to. And in many ways, it seems to me it's the image of today, the lost child that no one knows what to do with, who's sort of sitting there and is basically the seed of whatever is going to be our future in this century.
Yeah, well, that's you know what? I didn't think of that when I wrote that part of the book, but it's certainly true what you say. But actually, when I began to write that part of the book, that was based completely on my own experience.
Mm.
I had met this boy, a boy like this, a four-year-old child with a hare lip, whose parents actually dropped him off in the hospital in Sarajevo the day the siege began. They dropped him off in the hospital. They went home, and then the siege began. They couldn't come back. So he'd been in the hospital for 2 years alone by the time I met him. And when I asked the nurse, "Who's this kid?" So they said, "Well, we don't know. We don't know his name. And he's just been here very longer than we have, and we don't know who his parents are." And he was a pretty neglected child. And that really touched me as a journalist when I was there and when I met him in Sarajevo. And it stayed with me. And I always knew I was going to write a book about this kid, or that would begin with this. As Tom Lane does in the book, I went to visit this kid for 10 days. I bought him a little red guitar. And I got from my sound man a whole case of batteries to give this kid. And I gave it to a nurse and said, "Please give it to the boy so he can continue playing his little electrical guitar." And I went back the next day. All the batteries were gone. You know, Sarajevo under siege, they have more important things to do with batteries. But it was pretty sad. Yeah.
You give a shout out to Jim Aceta in the book, your colleague at NBC, who's a foreign correspondent, who's still doing the work. We've also lost Marie Colvin in Syria and Bob Simon of CBS in a tragic traffic accident. comment on the characters that you refer to in this book, the ones that you've known. I know you know both of those people, and what the end of these characters means for journalism.
I think, you know, in my career, I know at least six close friends who've been killed while working as journalists. I know a few dozen who are not such close friends. So it's a dangerous business covering wars, obviously, as a journalist. But I think it's not really fair, though, I think, to say that, you know, the golden age is over and people don't do that kind of work anymore. They do. But there's so many constraints now imposed by the networks on their staff to stay safe that what they do is different. I mean, I'll give you an example. This is going back a bit, but when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, for NBC, I went to Pakistan. I met up with a group of Mujahideen, and I walked over the Hindu Kush Mountains with them, and I was by myself. There was no bodyguard. It was just me with my camera. They'd never let that happen today. But the kind of reporting I was able to do, spending 3 weeks walking with these you know, band of fighters against the Russians, was pretty deep reporting. I mean, it was a real thing. I don't think you can do that today because it's just become so dangerous. The flow of information suffers. And I think another point is that today, whereas we used to go out and find the story of the day, today very often there's so many people involved in what you're going to do that day, from the editors to the producers, the different shows, we want this, we want that. They kind of tell the reporter what to do. And I think that's an important change. In the days of allowing the reporter to go off by himself in Sudan, Afghanistan, anywhere, Rwanda, Somalia, and come back with the story, it's quite rare today. And, of course, there's much less coverage of foreign news.
His new novel is The War Reporter. Martin Fletcher is a former NBC News Tel Aviv bureau chief and special correspondent for PBS. Martin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And give it up for Nelly at the end of this St. Louis hour. The rapper is proud of his St. Louis roots, but his answer to the unrest in Ferguson has not been an opportunity for him to throw his fame and celebrity around. You probably aren't aware that Nelly has been a community healer for a long time, sending two local students to college for the past 10 years. Nelly never went to college. He wanted to be a pro baseball player. He says, it's not about the hoo-ha. Thanks to Nelly, and thanks for listening. And thanks to St. Louis Public Radio. I'm John Hockenberry. I'll be in St. Louis today and tomorrow. See you then.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
NYC Now delivers breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. By sponsoring our programming, you'll reach a community of passionate listeners in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to learn more.